Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. We've all had this experience. You're in a crowd and a friend is talking to you. Maybe another friend is speaking to someone else and there are other conversations, noises, and distractions in your environment. And yet, our brain can tune out those other distractions, for the most part, and focus our attention on that one sound that matters, our friend's conversation. It's called selective attention. It's a critical skill in social situations, a workplace, and for children in classrooms. Psychologist Courtney Stevens has been studying how selective attention develops in children through non-invasive neuroimaging, scanning the brain to see where this skill occurs on the brain and what's happening when that skill isn't fully developed. She's also studying the impact of socioeconomic adversity on brain development in children. She's the director of the Cognitive Neuroscience Laboratory at Willamette University in Oregon, where she's an associate professor of psychology. This Thursday, she'll be giving the Judy Berry Honorary Lecture. That's tomorrow evening at 7 in Terrell Hall on the University of Tulsa campus. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Courtney Stevens, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Your work at the Cognitive Neuroscience Laboratory at your university is looking at how children's brain develop with certain factors, and you're sort of doing a lot of brain mapping given a certain set of circumstances. Tell us a little bit about the work of the Cognitive Neuroscience Laboratory.
Yeah, so our focus is really trying to be able to do what's called look non-invasively at the brain. So rather than waiting until someone has had an injury and look at how does behavior change, we can actually record the activity of neurons in the brain, and we can look and see how is that activity changing under different conditions. So some of my work has looked, for example, if we ask someone to focus selectively on one story, one set of sounds, and present a bunch of background information that really the person just needs to ignore and block out, how does the brain change the way it's processing that information that is being focused on compared to the information that's being ignored? So we can look at that sort of ability, and we can also look at how different abilities change in different conditions. And so, for example, we've done one study looking at the effects of 24-hour sleep deprivation on brain processing for different skills.
Now, you're focusing a lot on selective attention, the ability to sort of the cocktail party function, hearing other conversations going on around you, but being able to focus on one conversation that you're actually involved in. Is that a skill that normally humans pick up really early? I would think that would be something that would really develop in, you know, maybe I'm thinking adolescence or even maybe middle childhood as opposed to young childhood. When does the skill really develop in the average human? Do we know?
That is a great question. Definitely everyone has this sense of being in places, and you mentioned the cocktail party effect. If you're in a crowded room with lots of voices, how can you focus in on the person who's talking to you and ignore all these other conversations around you? And definitely we know that skill continues to improve through adolescence, but we've actually found that children, the youngest we've gone is 3 years old. But a three-year-old child can actually pick out one set of information, one story, one voice, and can focus on that voice and block out other information. Parents may have actually seen this in their children. If they bring their child to a playground, the child might be talking to someone else, and it may take a little bit for the child to hear the parent call to them or interrupt what the child is doing. And so what we really see changing developmentally through time is the ability for the brain, for a child's brain, to choose among many different possible voices or sounds and block out a range of different ones. But fundamentally, that ability, we can see differences in the brain as young as 3 years of age.
When you put it that way, that makes sense. But I'm thinking about the amount of stimulation needed to sort of create that selective attention. I'm thinking of a television set or maybe a gaming device. That any parent with children knows that can literally cut off all surrounding attention except that. But that is such an immersive stimulation. Are you saying that it doesn't have to be necessarily that immersive as far as the stimulation goes?
Yes, but I think you're raising a great point, which is that there can be sounds, and I think a video game or an exciting movie is an example of this, that really captures our attention, captures our focus in ways that are easy, simple, almost, you know, automatic and engrossing. But one thing that changes developmentally is how can someone make a choice, really have control over their own attention to choose what to focus on? For me, part of my interest in this as a research question is I think a lot about children who are in classrooms, and I teach at the college level, but I also visit kindergarten classrooms, preschool classrooms, seventh grade classrooms. And if you walk into any of those classrooms, there's really a lot going on. There's a lot of different voices, a lot of movement, a lot of things on the wall. And in order for a child really to get the most out of that instruction, I really look at that as a selective attention challenge. Can a child sort of choose to focus on whatever the task at hand might be? It might be a book that the child is reading. It might be the teacher's voice if the teacher is giving a lesson. But that's where we really think of someone needing to have control and choice over where their attention is focused. And that's a skill that we found to be important developmentally and something that we think of as important to foster really even as young as the preschool years. And so a child can get control over their brain, over their bodies, and at some level have the ability to choose where to focus attention versus you can think of almost being a slave or a servant to noises that are around you.
Yeah. Now, obviously, it does have huge implications for classrooms. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking about, I'm wondering if education has approached this on a pedagogical sort of viewpoint where you can walk by, say, a second or third grade class and you have this huge beehive of activity and then mm-hmm. yet another second or third grade classroom where it's absolutely quiet and the teacher is teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And we think of that as pedagogical, but could it also be have some sort of neurological or neuroscience function in how those kids are reacting to the teacher?
Mm-hmm. You can think of those two different examples or styles of a classroom. And really, in either case, the child does need the ability to selectively focus their attention. You know, one might argue that in the more beehive of activity classroom, there might be more demands on the child to be able to regulate their own attention. But something that we really see when you're asking about what's happening in the brain or what's happening at a neural level, that's something that my research has examined is really looking at, is the brain really processing information differently when you're focusing on it versus if your attention is somewhere else? And it turns out the brain is doing this. We can actually see what I call a neural signature of this process. And the analogy I use is that it's as though the brain has a volume control knob. And if you imagine first all of the sounds around you coming into the brain, and you can imagine them all being at a volume level of 5, what selective attention is doing and what we see actually happening in terms of the activity of neurons is it's like you're selectively picking out certain sounds and turning up the volume on that information. We see a signature that you could think of as reflective of more neural activity for processing of that particular sound. And simultaneously, you actually see a turning down of the volume on information that is irrelevant or not your focus of attention. In the research world, we think of this on the one hand of signal enhancement, so you turning up the volume on what you want to focus on, and then distract or suppression, where you're turning down the volume on information that's really not relevant to you at the moment.
Is that a conscious effort or is it autonomic to a degree?
So it's funny. Folks talk about two different types of attention. So the automatic that you refer to, if my door suddenly slammed closed, that would grab my attention automatically. And I would whip around and I would focus on that door. This type of attention that we're talking about is driven from the inside. Sometimes people refer to it as endogenous attention. And it is your conscious choice to focus on something. And so there's no inherent reason, for example, if I'm at a cocktail party, why I need to listen to one person over another. But if I've made that choice, again, my brain needs to be really turning up the volume on that signal or that sound source in order for me to be able to process it effectively.
Now, have we found there's ways to enhance that ability? That especially when you're talking about young kids, mm-hmm. you said you see this ability as young as age three. Mm-hmm. I would also imagine you see quite a few three-year-olds that really don't have that ability to really focus in.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We see a lot of individual differences in this ability. And some of my early work looked at kids who might have been struggling to learn how to read, or kids had something called specific language impairment. This is a difficulty being able to hear and understand language despite being perfectly smart kids. And in a lot of these different clinical populations we looked at, in addition to what was described as the difficulty in reading or the difficulty in using language, we found a difficulty in selective attention. And specifically, these kids were less able to sort of turn up the volume on what was attended and turn down the volume on what was being ignored or was irrelevant to their task. And one of the ways that I have sort of thought about this problem is you think even about reading words on a page in a book. You have to focus your attention selectively. If you can't, it's a sea of words. And one of the challenges of learning to read is being able to focus your attention on portions of those words as you learn to sound things out. One of the questions I've had as a researcher then is the extent to which selective attention might really be something that's important across a lot of different learning domains in ways that might not be recognized explicitly.
So it's about, as you're reading, it's focusing on nouns, verbs, objects to help you go along the story and to read faster, to understand the actions, whatever the narrative is taking place. It's the same thing in conversation?
Very potentially, and I would just elaborate a little bit more on what you said of reading and perhaps focusing on one word at a time or a content word. But try and imagine even when you are 5 or 6 years old and just learning how to read. And if you see the word telephone, part of being able to read is we tell children, sound it out. Move perhaps one syllable, one group of letters at a time. And that really requires the ability to selectively focus on portions of words. One thing that I would add is part of the work, and the work that I'll be talking about when I visit Tulsa, is looking not only at children who might be having a difficulty with reading or with language, but we've also found that often kids who are growing up in socioeconomically adverse conditions, who might be growing up in poverty, we see less of an ability very early in development to be able to especially turn down the volume on the information that a child might be trying to ignore. And that's really been the focus of some of our research working with parents and families and kids themselves, is to say, can we provide some different activities and settings and strategies that help a child to develop this ability? And I think it's really important to know that we have found that. Mm. And so this is absolutely a skill that can be trained and improved. And it's something that we've seen. I've seen it in kids who are 7 or 8 years old, and have also seen it in kids who are 3 or 4 years old.
My guest today is Courtney Stevens, Associate Professor of Psychology at Willamette University in Oregon and Director of their Cognitive Neuroscience Laboratory. She'll be giving the Judy Berry Honorary Lecture Thursday evening at 7 on the University of Tulsa campus in the Tyrrell Hall Auditorium, and she joins us today by phone here on Studio Tulsa. Well, what are some of the socioeconomic adverse situations you're actually, I assume you have to sort of catalog a variety of adverse situations. Can you maybe take us through some of that research?
Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of research out there for decades that has really looked at the lasting legacy of growing up in poverty. And statistically, 1 in 5 kids is growing up in poverty. And while every kid is going to be different, on average, if you look at a child 10, 15, 20 years later, on average, you'll see lower test scores. You might see more greater health difficulties. You would actually expect even an earlier age of death. This sounds very morbid, but it is what the data say. And part of the question is why might that be? Why might there be this lasting legacy? And one of the things we have really looked at is actually stress. And so if you think about the experience of perhaps trying to work multiple jobs to make ends meet, perhaps not having enough money to make ends meet, struggling to find consistent housing, if you think of the level of stress that both the parent and the children are under, that stress itself can have negative effects on the brain. And that has become really a focus in the research on the biology of early adversity, is looking at the pathway of stress on affecting brain development.
Of course, there's that level of stress of just poverty. But what about childhood trauma? And I'm thinking of a step beyond just the stresses of poverty. I'm thinking of violence in the household. Are you seeing kids in that situation as well? Because when I was thinking of this, it absolutely makes sense that they don't have selective attention because they're literally on guard, you know, sort of in the near flight mode, if you will, at all times.
No, I think you have intuitively thought of an explanation here, which is one that researchers talk about as well, which is in certain circumstances, it may not be adaptive to focus on just one thing.
It might not be in the host's interest, yeah.
Exactly, yeah, to be adaptive and aware of potential threats in the environment. And that's why I try and be very careful in my language. I hope I've been careful today of saying these are differences in aspects of selective attention. And one way of doing things might be more adaptive in one environment than another. And one thing that I really think about, however, is if a child is in a safe classroom environment, a child really needs to have the ability to turn on this skill in order to be making the most of the classroom environment.
Have you found strategies which automatically help that child turn up the volume?
Oh, good question. So for us, there's nothing that kind of snaps a finger and makes
no magic
it
pill.
No magic tricks for you today, I'm sorry. but what we have found in terms of the research, in one study I conducted, and it was interesting, it was actually looking at a successful intervention that was focused on reading, but the intervention really demanded that kids focus their attention. And what we found was in addition to reading improving, this selective attention skill also improved. We saw the same thing with a training program that was successful focusing on language skills. Where we really focus now when we're working with preschool kids, and especially children who might be growing up in the environment of poverty, is to give parents strategies for trying to increase predictability and consistency in the home, try and do things that will reduce, you know, not all stress, but some of the stress related to parenting. And after that 8-week program, we actually see that kids who've had that experience, before they came, they did not show this neural signature, and afterward they do. And so in that sense, I do think that there are both things that teachers can do in a classroom and also things that parents can do that will help to support the development of this skill.
Now, when I think of maybe a generation ago, I'm thinking of a lot of kids having this inability to easily turn up the volume, as you refer to selective attention, and it being diagnosed as an attention deficit issue. How big of an issue is that in what you're dealing with? Is this a common treatment, if you will?
So I actually, in my research, have never studied kids with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder.
No.
And so I can't speak as a scientist in terms of how this skill might be implicated there. And there's a little bit of an irony there that I study attention and actually to date have not studied the sort of what is typically described as the clinical manifestation of a difficulty with attention.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about this family training program that you have. What are some of the exercises you do with, say, parents in order to sort of foster this ability to selectively gain attention for a child?
So I would describe kind of a couple different prongs of strategies that we give parents. So first, there's some that might be focused on doing things like spending time reading with your child, using language. But then if I think of the strategies that might be more focused on reducing stress, one of the big ones is helping parents to create consistent, predictable routines for their child. And you can think of this on both a daily or a weekly sort of basis. So for example, many kids who participate in our studies might move between two or three different households during a week. And parents or caregivers might know the schedule that child is going to move through, but it might be completely opaque to the child. And so one of our strategies we have is actually making a big, giant sort of a calendar, but that is not connected to a specific month, and visual graphics representing different houses and reviewing this schedule with a child. And so the child can see, okay, tomorrow I'm going to this house that might represent grandma's house or might represent dad's house. And so that schedule can start to be anticipated by the child. It's reviewed. So that would be a weekly schedule. In the course of a day, there might be consistent schedules around when does a child go to school or even when is bedtime.
Yep. Meal time, bath time, study time, that sort of thing.
Exactly. And so to the extent that there can be a relatively consistent meal time, a relatively consistent bedtime, this is actually good for child development, especially young kids. They love routine.
Yeah.
And building routines also into some of these events. One of the things we often hear from parents is bedtime is a power struggle. And one of the reasons it can be a power struggle is parents might ask their children questions that we describe as empty questions. So if I ask my four-year-old child, do you want to go to bed?
No.
That's probably what you're going to hear. Exactly. And really, that question was empty because I don't care what the response is. And so there's subtle ways of reframing, whereas if instead I stated it's time for bed and say, would you like to brush your teeth first or put on your pajamas first? The child actually does have a meaningful choice.
Right.
What they say, what they choose does matter.
My guest today is Courtney Stevens. She's an associate professor of psychology at Willamette University and director of their Cognitive Neuroscience Laboratory. And she'll be giving the Judy Berry Honorary Lecture Thursday evening at 7 in Terrell Hall Auditorium on the TU campus. She's been studying the ability of both adults as well as children in developing selective attention. And I'm thinking of adults in your sleep studies. You did some interesting studies where you looked at the effect of sleep deprivation on adults' ability to have selective attention. What did you find there?
That was a fabulous study that actually originated with one of my undergraduate students, Eve Wiggins. And she had the experience as a college student, as many college students do, of occasionally being sleep deprived. And she knew of my research on selective attention. And she said to me, I think when people are sleep deprived, they lose this ability to selectively attend. And I told her, Eve, this is a great question. Is it possible nobody has studied it? And she went to the literature and looked, and really nobody had gotten at this question in a really scientifically clean way. And so we spent a few years actually collecting data. It was pretty amazing that participants were willing to be randomly assigned, and so we chose whether they were going to get a regular night of sleep or stay up all night with our research assistants in the lab. And then we looked at their ability to perform this task. And several other students wound up working on this project, also Malika Mottarella and Seth Eggleston and Kendra Good. And what we found, and in some ways this wasn't shocking to us, but if you stay up all night and then you're put in a situation or a condition where you need to focus selectively on one thing and block out some information that's irrelevant, you lose the ability to do it. Your brain is processing everything. Hmm. And what I love about that study is, number one, as an educator, I can walk into the classroom and I can tell my students, you might stay up all night and think that you're going to be great because you'll get a paper in, but you've basically made the next day of classes worthless. Because it is very, very hard to sit in class the next day and to be productive. And even more than that, from a public health standpoint, there's actually a lot of data suggesting that driving when you're very tired is just as bad as driving drunk. But people don't talk about it. So this tells us a little bit more about some of the mechanism of you know, one skill among many that might be compromised under conditions of sleep deprivation.
Now, the follow-up is, what about the chronically sleep-deprived? Has anybody looked at that, or is that something you're looking down the road, perhaps, at?
So there is some nuance and difference between what we think of as acute sleep deprivation versus you can have chronic sleep deprivation across many days where maybe you haven't even stayed up all night every night, but you were just sort of a few hours short each evening of the night. And there's a lot of similarities in the pattern that you see, but we haven't looked systematically at that in our lab.
Now, how do you actually measure the process? I've seen pictures, and it looks like you have like a little neural cap filled with sensors that your subjects are wearing. How do you actually, the actual process of measuring this selective attention?
So when four-year-olds come to our lab, we call it our spaghetti cap. And so you start by putting on essentially what is like a swim cap, but not as tight. And this swim cap has a lot of different holes in it. And in each of those holes, we can sort of plug in what it looks like is a stethoscope, a miniature stethoscope, but it's actually miniature electrodes. And those are then just, sitting on the outside of the hair near the scalp. And what we're able to do is use those electrodes to record huge groups of neurons in the brain that are active. Technically, they say there's enough electrical activity in your brain to light a very dim light bulb. So that's where you will see those cartoons with a little light bulb going off.
Mm-hmm.
We're using this spaghetti cap, if you will, to really record the activity of large groups of neurons, and then we have to kind of magnify it. And what we're able to do is then ask, what is the brain doing when we present, again, different types of stimuli? They might be words, they might be auditory sounds or visual pictures. And specifically in our lab, we're comparing how does the brain activity change for really the same auditory sounds that we can present when either your attention is focused on those sounds or focused on something else.
Well, sounds like really interesting research, and we look forward to hearing what you're going to talk about in the lecture Thursday evening on what you're finding about our ability to selectively have attention towards an individual subject in both the developing brain as well as the developed. It sounds really interesting. Courtney Stevens, thanks very much for joining us.
All right. Thank you so much for having me.
Courtney Stevens is an associate professor of psychology at Willamette University in Oregon and director of their Cognitive Neuroscience Laboratory. She'll be the guest of the University of Tulsa's Department of Psychology for the Judy O. Berry Honorary Lecture. That takes place tomorrow evening at 7 in Terrell Hall Auditorium on the TU campus. The event is free and open to the public. Information at 918-631-2894. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.